Colonel Warburton, Reel 3. Now, we've come to the point where you're getting ready for D-Day, your involvement. Now, you were going to be attached to the 50th Division.
What 50th Division?
That's it. That's what the book says, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And had you trained with them at all? As you know, getting ready to be with them, or were you only training with the armour?
We were really training with the armour mainly. We don't remember any combined exercises with them at all.
Right,
now we did something in Scotland. Now what the hell was it? We did a landing in Scotland on the northeast coast of Scotland somewhere near Muir Ward. Whatever that is.
It is there, Muir of Ord, yeah. But you don't remember that too well.
Well, what I remember about that is that it was the last chance for a full rehearsal of the invasion operation. And it was a very rough day. And the Navy wanted to call it off, but we understood that Montage insisted that this was the last chance there was of having a rehearsal, and he'd like to go ahead. And it was very, very rough. And I was put in an LCA, and these little landing craft things, not in a tank at all, with a whole lot of infantry. And the thing had just dropped off the landing. They had a landing ship that dropped these things down on the sides. This thing just touched the water, and I was so ill it's not true. And I felt absolutely terrible. And when we finally got ashore, I was just about conscious, and that was about all. And it really wasn't a great task from my point of view.
You were going ashore as a forward observation officer, were you?
A few days afterwards, it was decided that we would have another go because it had been so rough it was all spot, they said. And it was still fairly rough, but by some quirk of fate, everybody else on the assault boat was sick except me. And I went ashore, and it was the final rehearsal we had. And then we moved off to Bournemouth, I think, then after that.
Which we mentioned. Now, what about the loading up for the crossing?
Well, then, after the... when we were at Bournemouth and we'd concluded our waterproofing, we were then hanging about, waiting to see when what was going to happen, and we were finally briefed, and then we were sealed in.
What do you remember of the briefing?
I remember it being very exciting. I've been very impressed with the detailed information we had of the enemy positions and things. We had maps overprinted with all our positions in prior to the D-Day, which was a thing we hadn't seen before, and I thought it was very good start.
And what was the role of the SP guns to be?
Well, the role of the SP guns was to get ashore as quickly as they could. They were all waterproof, to get in with the first flight and give some artillery support when the running shoots had finished. They would do all the guns in the Navy were all firing as they came in, and then they stopped as soon as the first troops got ashore. And we were following the first troops. We got in immediately behind the first troops. We were, I believe, the first gunners to be ashore.
Now, you also wanted to tell me the origin of the name of the priest, which was your self-propelled gun.
I always understood that the priest had been so called because the inventor of the priest concept of a self-propelled gun was a fisherman, and he thought this would be the knockout blow for the enemy. Well, the fisherman's knockout blow for a fish is a priest, to call it a priest, which you hit the fish on the head and knock it and kill it. But since then, it's had all sorts of origins. But that was what I was told at the time, what the origin was in. But then the subsequent people came along, and they called the next one the bishop or the sexton, thinking that the priest was the connection with the church. Well, it was really originally it was supposed to be the fisherman's knockout tool.
Now, what did you think of the priest at this stage before you went into action with it? Did you think it was going to be an effective weapon, or yes, did you have your doubts?
They were very well satisfied, well pleased with it.
What did you like about them?
Well, it was so mobile. We were able to go where other things couldn't go. We could, where a tank could go, we could go. And we were able to follow the tanks or anywhere, wherever they went. And it was a very useful thing.
What about armour? Were you happy with that?
Well, the armour would keep small arms fire off and that sort of thing, and it wasn't really intended to do any more than that.
Now, what do you remember of the embarking onto the...
Well, it was remarkable because when we'd been briefed, we were all then virtually sealed into a camp, confined to a camp.
Would that be Bewley Camp?
That would be Bewley, yes. And I can well remember my first night in this thing. We were in Bell Tent, and I was given a tent underneath a enormous magnolia tree, which I'll never forget. And in this tree were two nightingales just above my tent. I'd never heard a nightingale before. And I was hearing this song all night, I was just thrilled. And then, of course, there was this the hiccup that didn't go where we thought we were going to go, and then a lot to do. And eventually, we got the all clear to go, and we were all very, very nervous and worried about what was going to happen to us, one thing or another.
How did you feel yourself? I mean, because it was your first time in action coming up.
First time in action. It was all completely terrifying, really, in a way, to us, because we didn't know what was going to happen. Which is probably as well, because when we did finally land...
Hang on, what about the getting on the boats?
Up in Southampton, as far as I remember, Southampton Harbour. Which was absolutely chock-a-block.
Was there any problems?
There was no problem. We went straight on board. We had four guns, a troop on one SP.
And this was a landing ship tank, wasn't it?
Yes, landing ship tank. And I went over with the CO of the Shell Rangers on his LCT with my tank then, as I had. I had a Sherman tank with a tin gun.
A pretend gun,
yes.
With an extra radio, which you mentioned.
Yes, extra radio and cable instead of the 75mm.
And what did you think of the Sherman that you had?
They were very, very good tanks, but the armour was a little bit soft for the high-powered German 88 and 75mm guns. But they were very reliable, and my tank, I was knocked out on D-Day, actually.
We'll come to that. Now, so you were in a Sherman tank with the Sherwood Rangers.
Yes,
you were attached to them.
Attached to the Sherwood Rangers.
And they were also, I presume, obviously, they were a Sherman regiment.
Yes.
And what about the crossing? What do you remember of that?
Well, I can't think of the word, but we tried to get a bit of rest during the night. But we were all awake very early. We didn't get a lot of sleep that night. And at first light, we were more or less on the beach, or very soon after.
Well, what could you see at first light as you approached the beach? Had the infantry already gone in?
We could see a lot of sand dunes and things, and that's about all. And our LCT skipper, the naval man, was very keen to try and get us ashore without getting wet, you know, without getting into a bottle door. And he came full ahead together right onto the beach. So we had a very good landing. We didn't get we really hardly needed waterproofing.
Now, whereabouts on the beach did you land? And which beach was it?
It was Gold, I think, wasn't it?
I think so.
I think it was Gold.
And
there were quite a lot of things around about then, you know, bits of this and bits of that had been blown up by then.
Was the beach under fire? As you landed?
I'm sorry?
Was the beach under fire as you landed?
Yes, yes, it was.
And how did you react to that?
That was very unpleasant and very unexpected, because with the amount of air bombs that were being dropped and the amount of all the Navy firing, then we expected the front end to be flat. Well, I got my tank onto the beach road, you know, there's the sands, then there's two sand dunes, and then there's the beach road. And when I looked round to the right, back to the sea, I found that the sand dunes were full of Germans still running about. And they'd camouflage themselves, so there couldn't be anything there at all. And they must have been well under cover when all this bombardment was taken out, and they're there all the time. There was a pillbox at the end of this thing, still firing, still shooting at things coming in, and then it changed its ideas and saw my tank coming on this sea, this beach road, and I thought to myself, I'm bloody sure that thing's pointing at me. And you see this thing, it was about 150 yards away. And so I started with my driver to pull the fire extinguisher, but by sort of instinct, I didn't. And at that very moment, the thing hit me and cut my engine into about 50 pieces. And we never caught fire. And I never remember seeing a Sherman hit. And I saw many, many Shermans hit. Without going up straight into flames, you know, at least we go straight up. And the Sherman Rangers had the most appalling casualties throughout.
So this pillbox, it was an artillery piece inside it, not a machine.
Yes.
And it had directly hit your engine.
Yes.
So
a direct hit. Yes. And I was out of action.
How did you bail out? Had you practiced bailing out?
No, we hadn't, but we didn't need any. The quickest bailout has ever been. You don't need a second. Surprising how what you can do when you have to do it. So having done that,
and it didn't catch fire.
No, never did catch fire. I then saw one of the regimental self-propelled guns coming ashore. So I got hold of him, the number one. He didn't seem to know what was going on, and pointed him out where this toolbox was, which was within good range for him. I said, blow that damn thing up, it just hit me. And he did. He got his SP on the thing and knocked the thing out. And then, of course, then I had the problem of finding some other way of getting onto the regiment. And I had a spare tank that was coming ashore later on, and I managed to find that, and then caught up with the Sherman Rangers.
What was it like inside a Sherman in action in those circumstances?
Well, you're very confined. There's not a lot of space.
Were you in the turret with the wireless?
Yes, I had the turret on. I had the full tank.
But were you in the turret in the commander's position?
Yes, yes. I was in the turret. In the command, yes.
So you would direct the tank as if you were a tank officer.
Sure, the tank. Yeah.
Now, what happened next then? What's the next thing you remember?
Well, so having found this other tank and collected by crew, we then joined the Third Rangers just inland a little bit, and we collected what they called a leader, which we had the whole regiment, guns pointing out, was in there for the night. And just as it was getting dark, a German plane flew over very low, and there was a blinding flash. And we all got actually panicked, didn't know what had happened or anything else. And eventually it turned out that this blinding flash had been caused by one of the things we were issued with, special rations, was some tins of soup which had a self-heating arrangement on the top. Well, he'd lit the fuse, but he hadn't punctured the tin, and it had exploded. And we thought the Germans had dropped some frightful flare or something. In fact, it was a tin of soup that had gone off in. Which was a relief.
Now, what was the situation? So you were in this lager, and they'd pushed the Germans back, obviously, beyond that,
yes,
and cleared up these infantry and the rest,
yes,
of it. Had you seen any more of these infantry, that you know, or was it the pillbox that mainly concerned you?
Well, not at that time, no. They'd cleared up Le Hamel by then, which was a little village near Gold Beach. And I don't know what happened the next day. We seemed to move on fairly well the first day or two. This is where we got to Cannes that we seemed to be stuck.
Right, so you don't. The next 2 days are a bit. You're not so sure. What do you remember about the fighting in Cannes then?
Well, we seemed to make very little headway. That was really the gist of the thing. And, we just seemed to be stuck. We didn't seem to be getting anywhere at all.
So where were you? Whereabouts? Do you remember the village?
We were just outside Cannes at that time.
Do you know whereabouts? So we can't go through this period, obviously, day by day, but could you give us some general impressions of your duty as the FOO, supporting the Sherwood Rangers in this sort of static period in front of Cannes? Were the guns in action much?
Well, the guns were always in action, but there was so little progress, nothing seemed to be happening for a very long time.
Would you'd be living with the Sherwoods?
Oh yes, I was with the Sherwood Rangers then. Yes.
How did you get on with the officers of the Sherwood Rangers?
Very well.
Any particular characters you recall?
Well, I had a very fine commanding officer. The commanding officer that I came ashore with, he was wounded on D-Day and he went back. And the one that took over was Colonel Christofferson, who wasn't a regular soldier. And we had a very regular brigade commander, armored brigade commander, who didn't reckon much to T.A. Sherwood. I was trying to get him replaced, but the powers that be wouldn't have it. And he made a marvelous CO. And the Sherwood Rangers themselves, when General Horrocks came to see them on that final parade, he said that the Sherwood Rangers had more battles than any other regiment in the whole British Army. He used to use them for every battle that he went into. He used to use them for the leading thing. So as a result, they had the most appalling casualties. But they
what about the other officers of the Sherwood Rangers? What about the other officers? Any others you recall? Or any particular pals?
Well, of the officers who landed on D-Day, at the end of the war, there were, I think, three left, which is appalling, really, three or four at the most.
Did morale suffer in the Sherwood Rangers? Because sometimes units are proud to be always at the front, but they also don't like it. You know, I mean, they object to always being first in line and always. How was morale in the
morale was always very high in the Sherwood Rangers, and they were a very good regiment. And it speaks volumes of it. Very often, when regiments did have severe casualties, they sent what was left of the regiment as reinforcements for the other regiment. But the Sherwood Rangers hung on for the whole time, which speaks very highly for them.
What were you actually doing as forward observation officer during this static period?
Well, during the static period, I used to talk to the officer sometimes, because in that Normandy country, it was impossible to find an OP where you could see anything. So I got all the officers and tank commanders mainly, who also couldn't see very far, but they could see something. And if they could spot a target, I showed them how to use the guns. And they used to send the messages to me, and I used to send them straight back to guns. And it worked very well, because we then covered a tremendous zone of fire, and they had the interest to be able to fire the guns as well as me, which was very satisfactory. And I think it worked very well.
And we were
always able to get through to guns for support throughout the whole war. We were never out of communication with the gun air. Which is quite something. It speaks very well for the wireless communication.
Now, you were troop commander, but you were never with your troop from the start.
No, hardly ever.
Did that make it different? I mean, your second in command would obviously take over the bulk of the work.
The gun position officer, and there was a battery captain who was looking after the two troops. There were two things that the battery used to be about. But the gun position officer was the fellow who looked after the guns, you see.
Now, I believe you were actually back with them once, by chance, when there was when they were hit. Can you tell us about that?
The guns had moved right forward behind a hill, and unfortunately, this must have been previously marked by the enemy, who opened fire on the position.
Artillery fire,
and we suffered some casualties.
What do you remember of it?
It was a very sharp firing, and we immediately after the fire ceased, we moved to an alternative position. We had to move quick shot.
Was there much damage?
One river was completely knocked out, and several received minor damage.
Any casualties?
We had several casualties. An officer killed, and several men wounded.
Now, anything else about that time?
It was a very nasty lesson for us. And made us very aware of how important it was to have an alternative position.
Now, what's the next thing you remember?
We move forward again.
You don't remember Goodwood?
I can't remember.
It won't help you in there, no. I mean, if you don't remember it, you don't remember
it. No, I don't remember it.
So what about the advance forward towards Falaise?
Well, when we get when this is the breakout. When the breakout came, we went very quickly. The first day we covered something like 60 miles. And at the end of the day, we were all absolutely wet with the dust and general dirt. And we leaguered for the night, wondering quite what was going to happen next. But however, the next morning we pressed on again.
Was there a problem with fuel in a fast advance like that, and things like that? I mean, were communications a problem?
We were never short of fuel. The Third Rangers had the most excellent arrangements for rations and fuel, and we were never short of rations, food, or ammunition, which was a considerable feat, considering it all had to come from Maramos. Right up to the end, and we took it stuff about a month in Germany.
As you advanced, did you pass through, did you see much sign of the German, the casualty in the Falaise area? There's supposed to have been a lot of...
Well, there was a certain amount of knocked out vehicles and a lot of horses, dead horses. And of course the whole countryside was strewn with dead cows and things.
And what's the next thing? So you're advancing?
Yes. I don't know where we got to. Next.
Was there much of a reception from the civilian population, you know, as you relieve various villages and towns?
We didn't seem to see very much of the civilian population. But many of the villages have been very badly knocked about. And very often it made our way through them very difficult. The roads have been so badly bombed and houses knocked down, it's difficult to get through sometimes.
Were there any big towns you went through that you recall? Any big towns where you get more population?
No, we didn't really go to anywhere until we got to Brussels, really.
Did you meet any resistance along the way?
Not any seriously. We didn't. Not a regiment of tanks, no.